I'm just looking at like where this is all going, and like all of these governments are going to get to a point where they know they can't afford anything anymore. And like, I don't know where that's at in the timeline, or but the trend is very clear that they're going to get to this point where they're like, oh my God, we can't afford to pay for anything. We have to raid treasuries, the treasuries of people that have a lot of Bitcoin.
What is up, guys? Welcome back to the show. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. The show is brought to you by Swan Bitcoin, the place to buy Bitcoin easily and automatically, set up a long-term savings plan, and plug your life into a Bitcoin standard. I actually just bought Bitcoin over there yesterday on top of just my normal stacking plan because I don't know, it just felt right, and I had a little bit of extra fiat, and I was kind of getting nervous about holding fiat. And this show is also brought to you by CoinKite, the makers of the Cold Card hardware wallet, which is how I keep my Bitcoin safe. When I withdraw it, when I do an automatic withdrawal from Swan, I send it to my cold storage, and I've got the Cold Card hardware wallet keeping my keys safe. There's a discount code and a link right in the show notes for both of those things, so check them out. I've got an awesome chat today. I have been meaning to get Preston back on the show for a really long time. We just had a lot of catching up to do, and we talked about all sorts of things. We ended up going a bit down the AI rabbit hole again as well, because he's been kind of digging in all of that stuff and using it in his own space. And I still think it's deeply relevant to the whole Bitcoin conversation because, you know, we're a network of builders. We're people who, When you see a problem, you tackle it and you see like there's a solution. Like, we're not waiting for someone else to fix stuff for us. We realize that if we don't fix it, there is no solution. And that's really kind of like the heart of what Bitcoin is about, is like building our own solutions and building our own alternative economy. But Preston always has a fascinating perspective, and he's super knowledgeable, and he spends so much time diving into all of this stuff on his show, on the Investors podcast, the We Study Billionaires, and he does the Bitcoin Fundamentals shows. I've listened to it pretty regularly, and I highly recommend it if you do not know it. And obviously follow Preston, but we get into literally everything, and it's a really fun one, and I hope you guys really enjoy this episode. So without further ado, let's get into our conversation with Preston Pish. Dude, welcome back, actually, to Bitcoin Audible. It has been a really, really long time. It's funny, the first episode we did together on this show, like, it was Chat 58. I actually just looked it up just to see, which was 3.5-4 years ago almost.
Stop!
Now.
Really?
It's crazy. Yeah, it's a long-ass time ago. But I remember that, like, the show was still, like, in the process of, you know, growing quite a bit. Like, it hadn't been quote unquote established at that point. But I remember somebody shared that episode somewhere, and it absolutely blew up. Like, my normal was like 2,000 downloads per episode, and that one got like 22 or 23,000. Oh, wow. Like, and I was like, what the hell happened? I never found out where it got shared. Like, it was on Reddit or something somewhere deep in some corner. But I thought that was really funny. I never figured out why.
Sometimes you're just surprised at what happens, you know?
Yeah. Well, Preston Pish, welcome, Batman. Good to have you on the show.
Great to be here. Great to be hanging with you.
For sure. For sure. It's been too long. Are you going to BitBlog Moon, by the way? Or what conferences are you going to?
So, let's see here. I am going to the one in Nashville in the summer. I'm getting ready to go to El Salvador. I'm going over to Peter's thing that he's doing in the UK here in April. And then I might do maybe one more before the end of the year. Haven't necessarily decided.
Gotcha.
What I'm going to do.
Yeah, dude, I slashed like crazy. I am going to Lugano, though. I mean, I'm pretty excited about Plan B, and I hadn't gone to any of the European conferences yet. I will be at Nashville. We should definitely hang out. And what's the Peter thing?
Peter's doing this it's like a combined thing with this football club and like Bitcoin, just chill session that weekend. I don't know what I'm really looking forward to it because I think it's just going to be kind of a smaller group of people and just like, I don't know.
It's going to be a unique thing rather than just like another conference or in, you know, in this place.
And I've always wanted to go to the coveted Bedford.
What's the El Salvador? Are you going for any particular reason?
For the having party. They're having a having party. Yeah.
Shit.
Yeah. All the memers, which is like, how do you say no to them?
I know. Dude, Sean's giving me so much shit about it. Sean Harris like hit me. I was like, you're coming, right? You're coming.
And there's still time. Fuck. There's still time.
There is. I might FOMO. We'll see. I wanted to ask, I actually wanted to start this off with something really simple. Is what in like the last 2 to 3 years has happened that we need to talk about? Like that, what's the thing that you've caught on? Like, I've listened to a couple episodes of the Bitcoin Fundamentals. I try to keep up with, you know, the Bitcoin run. And I did listen to the one with Pierre Richard recently. And I'm constantly like surprised that even being swallowed by this space, I'd be like, oh shit, I didn't know that. Or like, you know, I didn't even realize that this happened. So what's the thing that I think that stands out in your mind in maybe the last 2 years?
I would just say in the last 6 months, I think that, watching BlackRock swing from ESG this and that to like literally having people like Troy Cross or Alex Gladstein like speak at an event to talk about how Bitcoin is the most ESG friendly thing on the planet. Like watching that poll swing from like literally a 180 in 3 months is I think deeply underappreciated.
Yeah. Yeah.
And even though I just like smirk and like roll my eyes when I hear the word BlackRock, I think what it is showing you is like the early signs of then they join you. And we've always said that would happen. We always like talked about it, but to like literally see it play out and watching the pace of it play out is somewhat mind blowing. Now, I don't know if they're joining us so that they can then attack us, which may be the case, but either way, they're being forced to play our game as opposed to us to play their game. And I think that's a huge thing for people to think about.
I
hate to talk about this because you don't want to like propagate like negative waves into the ether, but I'm just looking at like where this is all going and like all of these governments are going to get to a point where they know they can't afford anything anymore. And like, I don't know where that's at in the timeline but the trend is very clear that they're going to get to this point where they're like, oh my God, we can't afford to pay for anything. We have to raid treasuries, the treasuries of people that have a lot of Bitcoin. And like, that's my biggest concern moving forward and why, although it's really fun to talk about like how many Bitcoin are getting gobbled up in these ETFs and everything, I'm just also looking at and saying, oh my God, the honeypot's just getting bigger and bigger.
Yeah, it's a big risk factor when you're thinking about the political risk, the political jurisdiction. Yeah, for sure.
And like listening to Brian Armstrong talk about how he's custodying like 90% of all the coins out of the ETFs, I'm just like it's the emoji of like the hand like straight to the palm kind of thing. Like, really? Jesus. We're not talking about this. Like, why are we not talking about how stupid this is right now?
Yeah, I think I even brought it up in just kind of one of my ramblings on an episode recently that I think when we go through, you know, we kind of go through these cycles of like stress testing and then the flourishing of our solution that was built out of the stress test, you know, like with this back and forth. And it feels like something, I think the context that I put it in is that like, I think it makes so much sense that if you look 10 years into the future, that we look 10 years back and we talk about that time where that huge institutional player accidentally burned all of those keys. Like that we're so fresh in this market that I feel like there has to be some sort of really big, like, rip the Band-Aid off. Somebody's going to F up really bad in some sort of a way, whether it's lost keys, whether it's hacked, whether it's a government confiscation because they did not they did not de-risk politically. You know, they only de-risked, you know, locally by via hard drive or, you know, gold card or, you know, hardware wallet thing. I can see us finally hitting that point with so many fresh eyes, like so many, so many fresh people thinking that, like, probably that they're way better prepared for this because they have security infrastructure already and they think about, you know, going, you know, moving slow, you know, making slow decisions and stuff and doing good security, but they're also in the habit of just trusting the other person. Like they're in an incredibly like just trust the other big name environment. And I think that lends itself to the likelihood of a mistake,
no doubt about it,
a bad outcome.
Yeah, it's if anything, the fiat has conditioned the mind to just trust others, to not perform proof of work, for do not take self-responsibility. Everybody else is responsible for any type of mistakes or bad outcomes that come upon you. And like all of those things are literally the antithesis of Bitcoin. And so, you know, you just want to be able to smash buy on your, Charles Schwab account, know, well,
easy.
Be ready that, unfortunately, there's risks that you're assuming by doing that. And whether you realize them or not is not anybody's fault but yourself. And yeah, we can talk about it and say all these things. But unfortunately, for a lot of people, they're just like, yeah, that seems like a lot of work. So I'm just going to do it this way.
Yeah. For better or for worse, humans mostly learn after they burn themselves on the stove, not before.
Yeah. Same reason everybody had their deposits on FTX and all these other exchanges. And speaking of which, I read something recently that was weird. It's like, so they had almost, I think it was a $9 or $10 billion hole when FTX failed. And then I just read something that because of like the coins or whatever that they're still holding through the bankruptcy, that the amount has like almost exceeded the hole that they had before because of the resurgence. So it's like one of the only bankruptcies that's ever occurred. And like, as they're going through bankruptcy proceedings, they're dealing with at par or above par value of like the underlying
denominated in dollars.
Doubt. In dollars, like these people that had deposits are going to get totally rugged, like to the nth degree. Like they're going to get something back, but it's going to be at like the 16,000 per coin valuation. It's going to be such a rugging, but just hilarious that like you would see such a dynamic play out.
That
only,
is crazy.
Only, yeah, it's only in this space that you see such insanity.
God, that's gotta hurt. That's gotta hurt.
Yeah,
to like watch. It's like part like the incredible, like how slow and painful the process of the judicial system is, like, and just like clearing it out, and why, God, you just do not want to be stuck in something like that. You know, there was, it was a couple of years ago. I think it was Hotep Jesus at the Bitcoin conference who was talking about how like he didn't even want to hold his own keys because like it was too uncomfortable, and he wants to be able to he wants it to be with somebody so he can sue your ass if you lose my keys or whatever. And I was like, dude, like you have no comprehension of like what kind of problem you're setting. You want to deal with people still haven't gotten paid for Mt. Gox. People still not have not gotten paid. I know, because my brother is still stuck in that shit. Like, that was 2013. You know, like it's been a decade. Of course, he's not going to get his Bitcoin, but he's like, he's going to get like on par with like, oh God, I think it was like, you know, $1,000 per Bitcoin during that, up to 1,100-ish, like
really
during that whole situation. And he's going to get like $90. on the coin or something like that. And that's if it gets paid out. I'm still not convinced. I don't think he is either. They just keep sending emails. So he's going to get, he's going to have lost, you know, multiple Bitcoin, and he'll be able to buy like multiple Satoshis when he gets his payout. Oh, that hurts so
bad.
The
thing that's kind of mind blowing is like FTX just happened. Like, I mean, we're what, 2 years, two and a half, I don't even know, like 2.5 years from when that like all went down. And yet it's like the whole population's been duped into like, oh, well, yeah, that was that didn't really affect anybody.
Yeah.
They're just like all leaning into all this stuff right now. And I hope I'm like, I hope I'm really wrong. I hope I'm truly, I hope I'm really wrong about like of where that could potentially go. But I guess I'm just looking at the incentive structure and I'm saying this, these states, all of these states are going to become very desperate. They have to be. They have to become desperate. And they're going to have to find something to raid to keep the lights on and then to wind down. Because the sizing of like the government will wind down with enough time, but it is not going to be the snap of a finger. Like that's going to take, going to take decades maybe to wind it down and to normalize it because of the change in the incentive structure. So, but like initially, like once they come to this, this realization, like they have to raid the treasuries. They have no other choice. They can't raid the individuals. There's no enforcement there.
Yeah. Yeah. And that would also make sense just because like they need, I think in short order, they will need Bitcoin to back the dollar to try to backstop the dollar's plummeting. Especially,
you know what, just, that's a great, this is a really amazing point because if they're able to start doing that in a small percentage kind of way, I know Kennedy had had this as a proposal in his like every treasury that's issued, 1% is going to be backed by hard assets for the, you know, the duration of the issuance. And I think that if you could get governments to maybe start doing that, maybe it removes some of that incentive that I'm talking about, or at least makes it less potent and less scary. But in the same breath that I say that, I think you make Bitcoin go parabolic if a large developed nation starts announcing things like that.
Yeah. I think it'd have to be quiet, like packaged within a package thing that they snuck in there, you know? like they've got like a bundle of assets, and that bundle of assets has some index, and that index just happens to hold a lot of Bitcoin, you know?
Maybe that's the only way that you're able to, but then how is the market going to be able to appropriately value those securities if they don't know that it's in there?
Yeah, I don't know.
And so you got this reciprocal like issue that if they do it, it actually accelerates like hyper Bitcoinization, which then causes the problem.
Yeah.
And if they don't do it, it causes the problem.
Yeah. Well, if they don't do it, they just have the problem they created for themselves. You know, like
and
Bitcoin exists and there's nothing they can do about it. So, and you know, historically, like it's not as if governments have any tendency toward restraint at all.
Well, they have an incentive for the opposite right now.
Yeah. Of course. It'll certainly be interesting. I kind of feel like there will be like actually what you brought up at first, I think is kind of relevant here. And it's something that I found really, really interesting and is fun to think about from kind of a systems theory point of view, is that usually the people within an institution are aligned with the institution when, and not necessarily that they agree with the institution, but that their actions and how they support still require being aligned with the institution, which is why, you know, you can typically, even though it fails all the time, as much as it works, you can typically think of institutions as like personifications. It's like this corporation does this or thinks this, this government does this or thinks this. Because incentives essentially align for even the people who are potentially antagonistic toward those incentives or toward the ultimate conclusion or action, they would still engage in it because their interests simply align. You know, it's very much like, mm-hmm. oh, we're going to compromise our libertarian values to get more votes, like, which is, you know, the Libertarian Party has this like stupid idea that they're going to compromise on their values to get more votes and be like more washed down, and then they're going to win, and then they're going to be principles. You know, then they're yeah. going to implement libertarianism. It's like, well, no, like now you've just set the precedent. Now you've already admitted that when it was easy to hold up your principles, you failed. It's going to get harder. You know, like the incentives are always going to diverge further and further. But the interesting thing about, like, with what I think BlackRock is kind of an indication of, is that Bitcoin separates the incentives of the, it puts this kind of barrier, it puts this defensive shield between the individual's incentives and the institution's incentives. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, when you start to adopt Bitcoin, when you start to have some sort of a stake in Bitcoin, the individual is more likely to start aligning with the incentives of the Bitcoin system.
Mm-hmm.
And so Bitcoin starts to act like this institution of individuals that are all put in this position, and they have this direct benefit to help Bitcoin. And yes. to reframe the way they think about it so that it's positive for Bitcoin, because Bitcoin is positive for them. And mm-hmm. so what I think is interesting is that while I do agree that, well, it's kind of inevitable that we get to that point in the political institutions, how many Lego pieces get pulled out of that giant machine
yes.
that are no longer incentivized to help yes. them because they have Bitcoin on their balance sheet, because their constituents are super Bitcoin focused, because they have Bitcoin miners and they cannot have their grid, you know, they cannot have their grid stability threatened. Like, how many do they lose? And when there are that many holes in their front, so to speak, their actionable front, their military front in trying to attack Bitcoin, how much just goes through it? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It'll be a mess. I mean, that's pretty much guaranteed, I think.
I'm such an optimist too. So yeah. like, I don't want to come across as being this pessimistic doom and gloom type person. I'm truly the exact opposite of that. I look at the incentives and I guess I'm trying to quantify the risk so that it's talked about, so that it can be mitigated and built around, more so than saying, oh, this is going to be really, really bad, and like all these people are going to get screwed. And I know it might kind of come across in the latter as opposed to the former, but what I guess the conversation really kind of leads to is, you have this classic argument, the accelerationists are like, let's get this thing going, let's amp this baby up, because the longer we wait, the more pain we're going to continue to feel. Mm-hmm. Almost like, do ripping off the Band-Aid quickly, or do I rip it off really slowly and like get the feeling of every single hair coming off with it? And maybe it's a preference thing. You know, some people like to rip it off fast, some like to rip it off slow. I don't know which one is more advantageous to induce the least amount of pain into society. Through that transition, I really don't know. And I guess it really just doesn't matter, because it's going to do it however it does it.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
You know, I used to be on the accelerationist viewpoint. And I'll also agree with you on the other point, is that, like, I'm 100% an optimist too, but like, you're absolutely right. Like, you have to be real to have rational optimism. You know, you have to be yeah. honest with yourself if you want your optimism to actually line up with reality at all.
That's right.
And the simple fact of the matter is that, like, there's going to be a fight. There's going to be a fight. And
yeah.
there
already is a fight.
There is a fight. Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah.
And it's clearly going to get worse before it gets better. But even in the context of, like, the incentives of the individuals are aligned to protect Bitcoin, is it still requires an enormous amount of action and building and work. You know, like, so if we do nothing and just say the incentives will fix it, that's not how the incentives work. That's how you go against the incentives actually doing their job. It's to suggest that it will force you. It's going to hurt enough that you're going to get up off your ass and participate. Like, that's how the incentives work. So expect it to hurt that much. And if you want to offload the work or the responsibility to somebody else, it's not going to get fixed until it hurts enough that you get up and participate. You know what I mean?
This show is brought to you by the Cold Card Hardware Wallet. My favorite setup, which I know I talk about a lot, is the Nunchuck Wallet on mobile that just connects directly to or just talks NFC whenever I need to sign. The Nunchuck does not hold my keys. It is securely on my Cold Card, not connected to the internet, not vulnerable to a phishing email or any malware or anything like that. If I ever need to send a transaction, I just create the transaction on my Nunchuck wallet, and I tap it to my Cold Card, I hit sign, I tap it again, and then off it goes. There is no easier interface and way of interacting that grants a higher level of security, in my opinion, than that right there. It's genuinely incredible to me that we even have this capability in the Bitcoin space. And CoinKite has just made an entire suite of fascinating security and just fun Bitcoin devices and hardware products, like the block clock. Just connect it to your node and have it show the Bitcoin price, have it show the block height, just right there on your desk in this really cool package. If you haven't checked out what they have to offer, you definitely need to. And don't, when you go over there, do not forget that I have a 9% discount code. Bitcoin Audible, all one word, gets you 9% off. And you can go through the link in the show notes or just remember the discount code, which is not hard. It's just the name of the show. You can go through the link in the show notes to go right there or just go to the store, browse around, see what you want, get yourself a solid hardware wallet, experience the tap to send with a Cold Card hardware wallet. It's just kind of magical. And get notified for the Q1. I'm really stoked about my Cypherpunk BlackBerry, the new model that's going to be coming out. So check that out as well. Don't forget, 9% off. The link is right in the show notes. Go check them out.
I want to talk about the AI stuff.
We are going to get there.
I want to ask you. I want to ask you questions.
Should this be a half AI Unchained episode and half Bitcoin Audible?
It's just so fascinating. Topic is so fascinating to me.
It is,
like,
dude.
I guess I'm very fascinated about Bitcoin, and we talk about it all the time. But I guess for me personally, like, when I'm not recording and not doing things, I'm way more interested in just trying to understand AI.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I recently read this book called Scary Smart.
Scary Smart.
From this Google, Mo Gadot.
Mm-hmm.
And he's out of Google. And, like, really, really good book. But, like, the one part in there, it was, like, in the middle of the book. He's talking about how, like, Google was training these robots to, like, pick up a ball. And how they had this whole room of these robots, and like the way that they were like plowing through their, like, basically creating their own code was they were just trying and failing and failing. And then, like, one of them would get a step closer, and like the update to that learning would like flow to all the other robots. Instant social learning, and then it's going to all the robots, and they're that much closer, and then they're tinkering, and the code is figuring out how do I phrase this? It was figuring out what doesn't work,
mm-hmm.
and when something would work, it would then flow to the rest of the robots,
mm-hmm.
and so, like, intelligence is figuring out what doesn't work.
It's brute forcing. It's brute forcing reality. Evolution is a system of brute forcing reality.
Well, wouldn't you go a step further and say intelligence is brute forcing reality? But anyway, like the story in the book, I'm reading this, and then he goes, and then he gets into this other section, and he's like, so like, what is it? Like, well, the fact of the matter is we really don't know. We can't. Even though we're watching it happen and we're watching it unfold, we just don't really understand it. It's like, how in the world can you like make these models, these language models and all these things, and like not like be able to fully quantify what it is?
Yeah.
And it's just racking my brain. And then I guess for me, I'm looking at like these language models, and I'm looking at how recursive it is, and how you're taking the output. Well, you're first supplying an input into it, which is the question or whatever. And then it starts to respond by guessing what, or predicting what the first word is going to be in the mm-hmm. response. And then it's plowing that first word back in as an input. And it's this giant recursive loop of what you fed it is then being fed back into it. And like, I'm looking at this, and I'm looking at just me and how I'm living my life. And I'm kind of like head tilted to the side and asking myself, am I interacting with intelligence in my day-to-day activities? Like, we all talk about like everything that we're interacting with is energy, but like, let's go maybe even a step further than that. And let's just treat it as if we're interacting with intelligence itself. And then it gets really like, when you're thinking about the reciprocal nature of how these large language models work, I'm starting to say, all right, all these books that I read are all about like being positive and being like on a net basis, on like a long-term basis, you're able to profoundly impact your life by keeping a positive mindset and by interacting with your environment in a way that you're thankful and that you are, if I'm always going around and saying, this sucks, this world is terrible, that person's a horrible person, this is never going to work, I'm literally like that robot trying to pick up the ball at Google, that instead of trying to find what works in the sea of things that have failed, I'm doing literally the polar opposite.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know, like all of this stuff that's emerging out of AI has me deeply thinking about just myself and how I'm interacting with my own environment on a day-to-day basis, and just saying, hold on a second. What if I'm interacting with intelligence itself, and just like, it's this giant reciprocal machine that is like playing out like my own desires and all these other like super stupid cosmic stuff that I guess I'm just rambling all over the place.
Now, there's a really interesting degree of truth to that, because you know, one of the fascinating things, like going back to the thing where you were saying intelligence is brute forcing reality, and I was saying evolution is brute forcing reality, is that if you really kind of extend that, is intelligence is the virtual result of evolution brute forcing reality. It's the ability to extend, to accelerate the process of evolution into a virtual environment that is built to mimic all of the things that reality has beat into us over a million years of evolution. You know, we have set pathways in the human brain, and specifically we have open pathways. We have an open environment that allows us to continue to brute force with our hands and all of these things, so that if our environment changes, we can build new models and new pathways. We're basically a model creation machine. We create thousands and thousands of models. I don't know how many models of reality Rad already has, and he speaks like four words, you know, but he clearly understands, and he's putting together cause and effect. He's you know, playing with little puzzles and things, and he clearly has different models for different things. Like, we build a massive amount of intelligence that isn't even linguistic. And when you think about it, I think one of the things it reveals, and actually this is something I think you and I talked about at some point, when we did maybe the AI episode on your show, is that it's going to get us to start thinking about how we think. Yeah. Like, that essentially it pushes us up into a next layer, rather than using our thinking to come up with this toy or this tool or this thing, is that because that's kind of abstracted away into a set of modeled patterns that we can now kind of recreate, now our new layer is to, how do we think about how we think? Like, what it creates this systems thinking about our day-to-day lives and our day-to-day interactions. And what you just brought up, I thought was a really great point, because people don't realize how much they poison themselves from day to day. It's the whole woke mind virus is such a great example, because they walk around being like, everybody's racist. So if anything negative happens to them ever, it's because racism. It's because it's like, even though
it's a mindset,
there's a million potential alternative explanations as to why this happened. Maybe they were just in a hurry and they had to get around you. And so they kind of like brushed into you, and they weren't thinking like, I hate this person of this particular color, or you look like the wrong sexual orientation or something. And then they bumped into me. But what you do is you poison your ability to actually achieve anything, because you go into, you literally set the stage for your interaction with the other people, for the other person. A great thought experiment that I think would just produce a very obvious answer is, and which most people don't apply to their daily lives. If I went into like every mechanic, like some people tend to think that, oh, a mechanic is always screwing me, mostly because a car is a big complex thing and it's expensive and people have no idea how to judge if, sure, I guess that was broken. You know, I'll pay you $900. But if you went into every single mechanic and you treated them like they were going to screw you, like they were going to charge you an absurd amount, and they were going to, and everybody's like, oh, well, you know, your oil cap was broken. Did you know that or whatever? It's like, I'm not gonna pay for that. My oil cap wasn't broken. You made this up. You made this up. Like every single time at every interaction, you treated them like they were going to screw you. And you started your conversation like that. At the end of it, how likely are they to actually screw you, to actually charge you for rotors that they didn't replace or something like that? Versus if you go in being very, very friendly and you go in assuming that they're actually going to be entirely honest with you, what's the likelihood then of you getting screwed? And I think the obvious answer is that you're very likely to get screwed. In fact, an honest person might screw you in the first situation because they just don't like you. And in the second situation,
especially if you play this out 1,000 times.
Oh yeah, 100 times. The more times you do it, absolutely.
Yeah, because people get very myopic. Like they'll hear you say that and they'll be like, well, this one time that I went there, that was not what happened. And I'm thinking,
you're outlier.
Yeah, but let's do it 1,000 times.
Yeah. And what's your probability?
Yeah, let's figure out the net on 1,000 times of you doing this. And, you know, like your input is drastically impacting the output you're receiving.
It's a huge part of the recipe. And it's in every recipe. That's the other thing.
Every recipe.
Your mental framing and your how you introduce the social environment.
And people will say, well, I didn't even say anything.
That matters too.
No, and that's my point is, did you pick up on your body language? Because your body language is communicating maybe even stronger than what's coming out of your mouth sometimes.
Yeah.
And so you are communicating. You are sending information just through the way that you're smirking or talking or anything.
Yeah.
And some people are really bad at picking up on the cueings of body language, and others are really good. There's this one of my favorite books. I don't know if it'd be in the top 10, but it's up there. What every body, like your body is saying, it's all about like reading body language. It's so good. This guy,
I don't think I know this. What?
Oh my God, guy, this book, you read this book and the 2 weeks following reading this book, you're going to literally hear nothing anybody is saying. You're going to be looking at their body and be like, oh my God, what is that? This person is, it's so funny. And it's one of these really good books because the guy who wrote this book, he was like the lead body language expert for the FBI. And he's all about probabilities, and he's all about picking up high probability cues that are actually stemming from the inner core of the brain, as opposed to the outer neocortex type, deeper thinking, like I'm going to do this body language to manipulate the person, because and this is what he's really studied deeply, is there's some body language that is very, early in the brain's development. I'll give you a cue.
There's easy to pretend and there's hard to pretend, basically.
Yes, exactly. It's exactly right. So Like a person when they're being, when they really think they're being clever, will stick their tongue out the side of their mouth, like off to the side. And it's a really high, like a very high probability cue, body language type thing. I mean, there's a ton of them. And so he like outlines them all in this book in a way that are like high probability cues and other ones that could mean 20 different things that you like listen to a body language expert. They're talking about this and they're like pontificating on what it could be. And it could literally be 20 different things. So I like that aspect that he's like really kind of honing in on like the really high probability ones, as opposed to just like generically covering the topic. But sorry for the tangent.
No, that's great. I love book recommendations. And I've read and or watched a bunch of stuff, especially back in college. I went on this kick of like kind of just learning social dynamics, and like I was fascinated with the idea of like both biological and social attraction, and body language was like a huge part of that. But I actually do not know, or at least I don't think I know, what everybody is saying.
Dude,
as a
it's
book.
So funny.
So I'm going to have to check
there's
that.
There's good
out.
Pictures in it too. There's he has pictures in it, so you can kind of like read about like, oh, this one's hilarious. I got to tell you one more. So there's one in there that, and I was joking with Daniel Prince one time, because he had this picture where he was doing this, and I basically called him out on it. So you ever see somebody who's standing up and they've got their thumbs, especially for men, they got their thumbs in their belt loops and they're like framing their junk.
There's my stiff.
So there's this picture of Anthony Scaramucci back in the Trump White House when he and who was the chief of staff at the time?
You got me there.
Rince Priebus was the chief of staff, and these two evidently, and I don't know, I've exchanged a couple messages with Anthony, very few, but so I don't know, but back then, evidently, these two were just butting heads when Anthony was the communications director and Priebus was the chief of staff. So he's in charge of Anthony, basically. But there's this picture that got released in the public right before he got fired. And I mean, Anthony is right there with his fingers in that belt loop. And I mean, and it is like, and what the move is from like a body language. I know this is so ridiculous. How did we even get here? But from a body language standpoint, it's like this monster flex. Like, I'm the alpha dog in this effing room, and you better be careful or whatever, right?
That's hilarious.
And so anytime you see it, it's a little bit of a smirk, because it's a very strong like body language tell of like, and so when you're
it's a body smirk. It's like an
it's
aggressive
a body flex.
Body flex.
It's a peacock. It's literally like a peacock, like bring it. Like bring it on.
Oh, Jesus.
Now you're going to go to a conference, you're going to see like a group of five people standing there, and somebody's going to be standing like this, and you're just going to be like,
that guy's pointing out his junk. Everybody see that? Everybody see that, right?
I'm so sorry I brought this up. This is just a little awkward, but
no, see, that's another great thing. Like what's fascinating about AI actually in relation to stuff like this is that you talk about, like, they say they don't know what it is, you know, like what the outcome is it's because you can, like, genuinely, especially, I'm not sure if you listened to this episode or you read this piece or anything, the gentle introduction into large language models, just like how they work, how they encode and decode stuff. I covered it on the show and tried to make sense of it. And, you know, in a pretty vague, high level way, it's utterly fascinating. But what's interesting is that it's largely just a process. Like the model is the conclusion of the process. So it's actually interesting because it's a little bit similar to something like starting a fire. Like I know the conditions and I know the kind of the basic thermodynamics that go into setting the spark or whatever, but the outcome fire, I don't really know, because I understand the process that outputs fire doesn't mean I know anything about fire. And that process doesn't really inform much about fire, because fire then is its own thing. Fire is the result of the process. And in that same way, like it's essentially like something that we could brute force and or that we do brute force, but we don't kind of understand the outcome of it because it's just this constant recorrection in our brain, is that we're basically doing on a, like a hyper aggressive scale with a computer modeling system, and we're just doing it with computation, something that would take us years, decades or whatever to do, and we're slamming through it in a few hours to pull patterns out of stuff. And it's going to be really interesting when you just kind of have this no-nonsense view of what's going on in the world, especially like on the episode with you and Jeff Booth, I thought was fascinating with both of you individually trying to make your own little personal AIs in different ways. But when we get to a point where these things actually can, and if I had my own personal like self-hosted AI, I can't see any reason why I wouldn't want it to listen and see all the things that I go through in my conversations, because it's going to be able to pull through my notes and the things that I talked about. And this idea that I brought up is like, well, actually, this is a really good time to start looking into that idea right now. But in that same context is that it's going to be able to tell me that, like, listen, you know, you're frustrated that you didn't get a lot accomplished, but you realize you spent 3 hours on Twitter today. That and it's going to be this like flat. This is just how it is. And I can't like get angry at the AI because it's not going to have any, you know, preconceived notions as to whether it doesn't care whether it pisses me off or not. Like, it's just going to tell me, this is why. This is why you're stressed. And then in the same sense, it's like, what happens when, you know, you have an autistic person who doesn't have social cues, but they can be told this is what the body language is indicating about this person you're having a conversation with. And oh God, the couch investigators, when you have an AI that like reads the body language of a politician.
Oh yeah.
That's going to get fascinating.
Yeah. When I think about, biological intelligence versus synthetic intelligence, I think that one of the things that we're predisposed to from a biological intelligence standpoint is it's tuned to prioritize our most recent interactions way higher than the long term. I suspect. So like, and I think that's for good reason, because if our environmental setting is changing, like let's say I used to live in a desert when I was a kid, and now I'm living in the Arctic. Like, I have to be able to dynamically adjust to that newest setting and prioritize that newest setting with a higher weight than the maybe the earlier setting.
Yeah, yeah.
And so when we're looking at like synthetic intelligence, let's say that we had an AI that was following this person from their early days to their latter days. And obviously you could weight it any way you want, but I suspect that the weighting is going to be much more neutralized and probably it's going to be weighting the compression on that entire lifetime more equally. And so you're going to get maybe a more unbiased, as you interact with it, you're going to be able to get a much more unbiased viewpoint on the current situation than what your biological intelligence is maybe leading you to believe. Did any of that make sense? Like what I'm saying?
No. I'm totally following. Yeah.
Okay.
For sure. Because it simply doesn't have short-term bias. Because its weights are permanent. Its weights don't degrade unless you reweight it. You know, like you have to specifically decide to fine tune it in a different way in order for the broader patterns to start being over. Like, I think you're right that we have this. I mean, just because our memory degrades, our for 100 different reasons, we have an aggressive short-term weighting from just kind of like biological life.
I think some people would probably disagree with that, and they would say, and it would go something like this, of like, I was so traumatized as a child for X, Y, and Z reasons, and it has literally led me to why I make all the decisions I do now as a 40 or 50 year old person, and I can't unweight that trauma from whenever I was younger. That would be the counter argument to what I just said, but
it might be with the layer, like what sort of weighting, because there are, you know, just like they're kind of like, there's a whole range of shallow opinions and like minor things that inform actions all of the time. And then there's kind of like deeper values that don't always align with what we do, but are kind of like a gradual undertone, you know, like
maybe it's weighted more towards pain. So whatever pain,
that's interesting.
Yeah. So maybe that would probably be the better answer. It's like, mm-hmm. you are highly biased by whatever pain or I guess over the top reward you received,
mm-hmm.
that is what's biasing your compression of your past environmental factors.
Yeah. And the interesting thing about AI in that context is just that like, it won't have the same.
Not. Exactly.
Like it will give us a different perspective.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's something else that I find really, really fascinating, especially as we start to figure out how to automate and pull together like training and stuff, because like right now I realize that, you know, so much data is lost, and we're also right into the getting to the point of I just read an article that I didn't totally agree with the article, but there was some really kind of disturbing stuff talking about with like AI generated stuff for kids. It is just like, just sits like entire, and then there's like millions and millions of views, like because they're just sitting kids in front of these iPads and showing them like, oh yeah, learning colors or learning blocks or something. This is perfect. Like here, watch this for 60 minutes. And it's literally incoherent. Like it's, the entire thing is written by ChatGPT, and then it's run into a 3D generator. Mm. Like the entire thing, start to finish, somebody wrote a script, and they're pumping out these videos. They're not even watching them, and it's like watching something. Like I could not believe, like even while I was watching some of the examples, I could not believe how much my brain was trying to make a story out of it, like trying to make a plot that makes sense, because my brain was telling me there has to be a story here. This has to have a purpose, you know? And it was creating such an incredible degree of uncomfort that was just like building and building, because they'd just have some random music cutaway and then it would be back, and I'd be thinking, okay, here it's going to be meaningful. But I know the context going in, but my brain is still trying to make sense out of it. And it's like, but there's nothing here. And the whole thing is like this uncanny valley of just social interaction that doesn't make sense. The grammar isn't even quite right. Everything's bizarre. There's super awkward pauses. And then there's just like interruptions. And then like there's a total different thing. Like it completely changes. And this goes on for like 30 minutes or 60 minutes. And I just can't think, like, if you give that kind of stuff to a kid, like to a toddler, like how important is it that there is some sort of a meaning or conclusion to social interactions or to the formation of a story in our brains? Like, holy crap. And I mean, granted, I think this is a small transitional phase during the inshittification of the internet, as the word that they used that I thought was hilarious, because we're just kind of getting flooded with pollution or spam from the generative AI, the opening of the generative AI world, I guess. But that leads me to wonder, like, I think the data will be less important into the future. Like the historical, or not historical, the exact saving of everything that we see, and it will be more about fine-tuning our own models and saving our patterns. Like, it will be more important, not that like my entire podcast is saved somewhere so that somebody can go back and listen to it, but that essentially the computed, like high density patterns of knowledge and relationships that are the product of all of the tens of thousands of hours of reading and talking and bullshitting and, you know, all of that stuff, that product, that weight, that model at the end of it is actually what gets carried forward and integrated and used and leaned on for some reason or another. Like, and it might change specifically because of not being able to tell what data is real anymore, in a sense.
Yeah.
You know, it will matter more what we do individually and then what we can give to kind of trusted circles to start building collective knowledge that is separate from the whole generative AI, or that if it is even generative AI, it's something that we specifically judged and liked. And, you know, like it's something that had that human feedback and kind of the human touch to make meaning out of it.
Yeah. Your comment about the kids in like these videos is weird, concerning. Yeah. I don't necessarily have a word for it. It's interesting. As you were saying it, I was thinking of this really, it's not strange. It's literally like the foundation of like how all information shared over the internet. Yeah. Claude Shannon, his mathematical theory of communication, his landmark book. There's just such an odd, very counterintuitive point that comes out of his work, which is that high entropy means that there's more information content in the message. And so when you're describing that and it was weird and it didn't make sense and your brain was running wild, like trying to figure out the meaning of this deep amount of entropy and chaos in the clip is maybe really engaging for some really strange reason. And is therefore the information content is high.
That's interesting.
Weird, but doesn't make sense. I don't know. I'm just kind of rambling and just kind of like throwing out some really weird.
That's an interesting thought. But I wonder if it's part of a feedback. Like if it's a consequence, like, you know, I wonder if it's because of my social interactions when I was a kid that built those patterns, that built that expectation that now allows entropy to have a degree of uncomfort in the amount of engagement that I have with it because I'm trying to pull meaning out of something that doesn't have meaning. Yeah. But then does that child grow up with that bias? If nothing they watch has it, like they spent 2 hours a day watching completely meaningless, incoherent, plotless garbage.
Almost like it's programmed to be enticing to you as an adult that's already compressed, you know, I don't know how many years of environmental data. But for somebody who hasn't had that experience, it's like, what does that do to their wiring, especially if they're consuming a lot of that content?
Like
it's really strange.
It's strange. And as the article said, is that we're basically in a live experiment right now. Like we have no idea what the consequences of any of this is. And we're using our kids as test subjects in a lot of cases, which is
NVK. Yeah. Recently said, just like, get your kids off social media right now. And I kind of agree with him. Like and that's really rich. Like, you know, back when we were kids, it was like, don't consume so much TV content. And like, you just roll your eyes at your parents. And I guess now we're the parents like saying the same thing about them consuming like this stuff. And so like.
Swan Bitcoin has the full suite of Bitcoin financial services. You can instantly buy with your bank account or wire transfer any amount of Bitcoin up to $10 million worth. And you can easily set up what I have been doing for ages, which is an automatic purchase of Bitcoin on a weekly or monthly basis. You just pick your time frame and then automatically withdraw it to your cold storage. And still they have free withdrawals to self-custody, which I was sure would be gone by now. But you should always treat any custodian as a point of failure. And luckily, you won't have to go anywhere for all of the information and advice you need for why you should withdraw and how to do it safely, because Swan Bitcoin has all of the resources you need and will regularly remind you. About 80% or more of their customers automatically withdraw their coins. That is an amazing feat, if you ask me. Then they also have the Swan IRA if you have a traditional IRA and you want to get it allocated to Bitcoin. And there's so much more. With Swan Private, they have inheritance planning. You also have Swan business accounts, and you can even do Bitcoin as a part of your employee benefit plans. They have an advisory. They have the Swan Vault, a multi-sig service for those who want to have the benefits of holding the majority of their keys, but still also want to be able to rely on a trusted institution in the case of an emergency or a disaster. If you haven't started into Bitcoin yet, Swan is an amazing place to begin. Go to swan.com/guy. The link will be right there in the description. Again, that is swan.com/guy. And they will know that I sent you, and my beautiful face will be right there at the top of the page to greet you. I am a longtime user myself, and a huge thank you to Swan for supporting this show, and I definitely recommend you check them out.
I'm 100% there, though. Like, the setting the stage for the social interaction, you know, like I think it makes, like, you have to have, like, a grounding in reality, and I think social media is such an exaggeration of anything. It's as if you replace all of your personal experiences and your personal social interactions with public ones. And public and private is not the same, like, not even close. You build a completely different human being if you're stuck in one versus the other. I mean, look at people who grow up as celebrities from kids. They're all fucked up. They're all messed up in the head. That is what I think we're risking with kids thinking that the public social environment is the more important. Is how many followers do I have? You know, what do I publicly say to this other person in this argument to make sure that I'm the cooler looking person, you know, because it's not trying to reach some sort of a conclusion. It's trying to gotcha and, you know, mic drop on them and all this shit. And I really don't want that shit to poison Rad. I'll let him start figuring that out at 17 or 18, maybe. I don't know.
You can see it in their generation too, where they just put a lot of weight in followers and all that person's on this. And I'm just like rolling my eyes, like, oh my God, like, why do these kids, I think it's human nature. I think humans are somewhat predisposed to being socially accepted on a large scale.
Do a lot of status chasing. Like, it's
for cooperation thing. Purposes. Yeah. Maybe that's like built into our wiring or whatever, but yeah.
Well, I want to ask something real quick, because I know we're a little bit getting close to time here, but I still had like 100 things. First off, how's Ego Death going? And I'm curious your perspective on investing in kind of like VC and stuff in the Bitcoin-only space. Like, kind of give me the rundown there.
It's really exciting. I mean, for me personally, as a person who just really enjoys finance and investing and engineering and like all these things, it's kind of like the perfect crossroads for me personally. Like, I'm a total pig in mud and just deeply, deeply honored to be working with the team that is there. So like, when we're looking at it, I think it's really important to just kind of like play out some like broader themes. And like, when we think about payments technology, which we're obviously very interested in investing in and making sure that infrastructure has capital allocators and is providing value to the world, it's really important to make sure that you are aware of the timing and how that might naturally manifest itself. So like, when I'm thinking of payments, do I think payments are going to take off in the United States like anytime soon in Bitcoin terms? Nope. Because you don't have a natural incentive, demand incentive that's in place there.
Still cart before the horse.
We're still there. And people that are suspecting that it's anything other than that, I think are just literally lying to themselves. But when I think, so where will it? Well, it will where you have unbanked, where you have just an abomination of a local currency. And then when you're looking at the sizing of like how much GDP are happening in those countries versus the more developed ones that are probably going to be the last ones to be using it as payments technology, you got to have a realistic outlook as to what does that adoption curve look like over the next 10, 15, 20 years. And then you have to make sure that you're allocating capital in a very responsible way to founders that understand that and aren't delusional with their own product. And sometimes that can be kind of hard to find.
Yeah.
The other thing that you got to be really wary of is a lot of founders, they're so deep into their own thing, and they're so biased by needing to generate revenues like right away so that they can kind of continue to scale the company in this in this non-volatile kind of way. And so some of them will tell themselves stories or whatever, and others are deep efficiency operator experts that understand where they're at with that tech backdrop, mm-hmm. and they're going to be the ones that win. They're going to, and I mean, we all want everybody to win, but they're going to be the ones that are successful because they're just dealing with reality in a much more responsible way than the one that's just somewhat lying to themselves. Mm-hmm. And so we really try to be mindful of founders that can deal with that reality and that are properly identifying that environmental backdrop, and then have the technical chops to like, and the UX, you know, appreciation and like all mm-hmm. of the, all of those things. It's really hard to find founders that are a jack of all trades.
Yeah.
You really kind of need to be somewhat of a jack of all trades and be able to go a little deep on all those traits to be leading an organization that is going to be successful. Because if I there's so many stories, countless stories of founders that were very, very right about the idea, but very, very wrong about the timing.
Yeah. Timing and execution. Yeah.
And
yeah.
execution. Yeah. And that's one of the things that at Ego Death that we talk about as a team a lot, or some of those types of things. And then because on the one hand, we're hardcore Bitcoiners. We want to make sure that the infrastructure is there. We want to make sure that the capital is there. But at the same time, we are deeply looking at our LPs, and we want to be a good steward of their capital. And we want to make sure that we're allocating it in a way that, I mean, Bitcoin's our hurdle rate. If we can't, mm-hmm. if we can't outperform Bitcoin, yeah, well then what the heck are we doing?
That's tough.
Yeah. With something that has a compound annual growth rate of like 50%. And that's mm-hmm. like being conservative on an annualized basis. Mm-hmm. So like when you're looking at a hurdle rate like that, can you outperform it? I would argue you can, but you have to be in some type of industry that is predisposed to aggressive dematerialization on a very grand scale. And so mm-hmm. we are in that. We are in a sector that's literally dematerializing legacy finance. And so if you can go in there and you can buy a company for 15 million to 40 million and the upside on that technology or that business is, call it 500 million plus, well then you can kind of outperform Bitcoin. And then the kicker is all of these founders and all these people are looking at their retained earnings once they start generating free cash flows in Bitcoin hurdle rate terms.
Yeah.
And so they're going to be stacking their balance sheet with Bitcoin once they start generating those free cash flows. And that's the kicker that really kind of enables you to outperform. But all of that description that I just gave you, if you do 10 investments, can you do it at a probability that allows that outperformance to truly be an outperformance? Is that 7 mm-hmm. out of 10? Is that 6 out of 10? I don't know, but the math, because it really depends on the upside on some of the picks that you get, like some are going to be way outperforming so that you can do a smaller number. And that's some of the math and like how we think about like where we're at in the space, the challenges that we kind of deal with, balancing the interest of the LPs with the interest of Bitcoin being successful. And it's something that we take very, very seriously. It's something that is really fun to discuss with people like Lynn, Jeff, Nico, and Andy, and our advisors. And it's a blast. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah. Yeah. That's awesome. I've been feeling like, not that I have a lot of time to put something else on my plate, but I've been feeling like I've needed really bad to get into the idea. Like I need to think of myself as an investor, especially with like the capital that I have available now in Bitcoin, and to be able to really put back into it aside from just like, you know, producing media and content and all of that stuff. And, you know, I've taken like a small foray into that with the development project that we're working on, but that's like far more like, oh, I'm going to found a company rather than like be an investor or like start thinking about VC. But like what I can accomplish is insanely limited. And I feel like it makes so much more sense. And because of that, I've been listening to a bunch of startup and VC books. Like, you know, my tendency is when I start getting slightly interested in something is I read 30 books on it.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
What's that shit all behind you? What was all that? I'm listening to The Secrets of Sand Hill Road right now, actually. I'm about halfway through. I'm not sure if you've read that one.
I have not. Yeah.
But it's funny, like all I can do is think about it in the context of like Bitcoin, because all of this is all the conversation is denominated in fiat, is how much money, how much capital, what makes sense for VC, and you know, how strict like timelines are, in the sense it's like you have to realize that, like, you know, you have to push as fast as you can to see if you can get something out of this, because you have market timings for like where things are in cycles and, you know, all of this stuff and all I can think every time, like every like six pages, I'm like, Jesus Christ, this has to be so much harder with Bitcoin.
Yeah, I think it is. I think the just the mental construct of like what is a hurdle rate nowadays, when you fully understand Bitcoin, it's the math is like crazy. It doesn't even seem like it's legit. I think if you have the conversation on the math with like a person who doesn't fully understand Bitcoin, they're going to think you're literally out of your mind. You know, I guess maybe years in the space, almost a decade now for me, I've just come to it's become very normal, I guess, to talk in those terms.
Mm-hmm.
But
you don't think you're crazy, right? Most of us. I don't think I'm crazy.
what a setup question.
No, there's it's really interesting when thinking about like in the context of like Bitcoin, because you have to make, you know, 50% or something like that on annualized return. You have this hurdle rate, but it's also interesting to think about it in the context of the acceleration of technology and like kind of where we are, because it almost invariably means that the only thing to invest in is disruption. You know, to find something disruptive. And we went, you know, you go back to like the 80s or 70s and you think about like what, like a small corner of the market it would be to be looking for something for disruptive technology, and how long the span of time between disruptive technologies there were. And now it's just like, disruption. Like, it's just like, it's just like constant pounding. And we're in another era more densely, and just in the cycles of things, where, you know, the internet went through this massive disruption cycle. And then I feel like it started to level off and dip with the re-centralization of the internet and the consolidation into these massive platforms. And I think we're hitting another massive disruption cycle where we're not only going to disrupt all the things the internet had yet to disrupt, but we're going to redisrupt all of the things that have completed their disruption cycle or kind of started to go over the curve when it comes to like platforms and everything that had not previously had the proper incentives to scale, you know, far enough out into the future. They had basically minor misalignments that led to the very problematic outcomes that we have today. So.
I would equate it to, I think most people around the world are looking at the environment and they're saying, dear God, a Cat 5 hurricane is about to make landfall and the eye is coming straight through where we're at.
Mm-hmm.
And like, what can I do to just make sure I don't get annihilated? And then you have Bitcoiners that are saying, look at this baby. I think I'm going to go windsurfing today.
100%.
That can 100%. Be very disconcerting for many that are hearing or looking at that person, because they're saying that guy's nuts.
Dude, the weight is going to be so big.
Get the board ready.
Have you been following what I have been seeing as the resurgence of the banking crisis, the continuation of the put on pause banking crisis from 2 years ago?
What's so interesting is they wanted deflation in the worst way.
Mm-hmm.
And Silicon Valley Bank was that all day long. And so it's like, it showed up, it was there. They could have got so much deflation in fiat that it would have, I mean, boy, you talk about sucking the inflation out of the system like really fast.
Yep.
But if they would have allowed it to play out, like the destruction in supply chains and the perturbations of like what that would have caused, it would have been on par with what happened with COVID. And so they're kicking the can, and they're just kicking it in a way that systemically, like, they're just packing more and more pressure into the pressure tank. And we already know that the relief valve is broken. It's not going to allow the emergency release of liquidity in a responsible way. Mm-hmm. And like, the tank's going to explode, and they're just cramming more and more pressure into the tank by doing what they've been doing, which, like, you know, rescuing Silicon Valley Bank. And it's just, so like, I'm looking at the bond yield curve here in the US. It's trying to sell off to new levels. Like, the yields are, it appears to be maybe trying to make new highs by selling off. I'm looking at oil, and it's looking like oil's that monster is trying to come back. I wouldn't say that we've seen the bear market in oil reverse itself, but I'm looking at the price and I'm saying that's looking pretty interesting. And if it would start to kind of break through some levels, I think you're going to watch things happen in the treasury market that are mind blowing. And then Powell literally this week saying that they're looking at easing. You had the Swiss that are easing. You're watching the bond yield curve in Japan that's going, that's looking really strange, but they're not going to do any more, no more yield curve control, despite their market slightly starting to sell off again and looking like it might punch through some new lows. So
I don't know how they do anything. Like, it's like,
I'm just an observer.
Yeah.
I'm just sitting here sensing my environment with like a smirk and concern and jubilation and like every emotion you could possibly slap on that sucker, and just saying, hang on, because the Cat 5 hurricane's coming, and like, my surfboard's waxed. It's not going to be in the water. I'm just going to be flying around. It might get a little dangerous, but
yeah, it's crazy how much pressure they've built up. And I can't help but wonder how big of a factor Bitcoin is going to be. Because I think the ETFs are, I'm actually in the bitter opposition to Bitcoin episode that we just did, really great little Twitter thread on why it is that it's so critical that they don't have Bitcoin accessible in like a broad way in a fast response market, is because it's essentially an alarm bell. It's a canary in the coal mine for the financial system. And you cannot have pure price signals, because and it's crazy how fast this could even happen, is that at some point when we start to see Bitcoin moves, they will start to move aggressively in response to explicit policy decisions, and it will move very, very quickly. And then I think there will become a point where Bitcoin is big enough, where it has enough volume and just enough liquidity, that you actually see the reverse, that you actually see the opposing angle of this, where the liquidity of the treasury market or the kind of the opposing market to the Bitcoin side, rather than just seeing the Bitcoin market go up, you actually see a correction. You see a movement down in the liquidity that was flowing out of the bond
market.
This
is so fascinating that you're saying this right now, because I have thought about this as well, Guy, where maybe the spikes we saw in the past are almost like inverted moving forward, where they're like spikes down when fiat bids aggressively, because you're going through this massive cascading impairment. And then it shoots right back up. And it's almost like an inverse pattern of what we saw in the first decade of the price.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think as the liquidity becomes comparable, like the crazy thing about that is that, you know, it's been a big antagonistic point with Bitcoin is that, you know, supposedly it's all this, it's too volatile or whatever, and you know, you can't use it for anything. But I think as these policy decisions and things actually, because there's a release valve, because there's an, like, you can move the pressure in one direction, is that they won't have this benefit of, you know, 1,000 walls up that, you know, all have like small holes that, you know, can leak at different rates. So they can build up a massive amount of pressure and give the illusion of the effect that they want for 3 years. And then it leaks out into the next zone of the economy and to the next thing. And then finally it starts leaking out. So everything's like this huge lag. The result is this massive lagging indicator that's way behind their policy decisions. So they can just like 8 years later, they can blame it on the person who's there now, or they can just lie and be like, oh, the corporations are evil and all this stuff, because nobody sees that like eight years ago, the pressure was being built up that caused exactly what the situation is. But the thing is if you have this giant, like, just outflow that can that can pick up $1 trillion in a matter of hours, and you know when you're looking at $7-8 trillion, Bitcoin can do that as far as like a market cap easily. And when you do that, that means that, you know, they make a decision and Bitcoin does this and the treasury market does this, or the dollar does this, and you have enough liquidity that it actually shows up on the chart. But the thing is that, like, when you have that, I think you have a negative feedback loop for this side of the equation, for the dollar side of the equation, is that now you have two volatile assets. Now you have two things that respond, and you have one thing that responds positively and one thing that responds negatively. And you just want to leave the one that is negative. And as soon as anybody realizes that they need to make this decision at the same time or prior to this dip happening, that they need to leave, that dip gets, that gets worse, and this gets worse or better. And when that realization hits the market, like, I think that can just like it can just accelerate in both directions really, really quickly, unless something drastic happens. You know what I mean?
There's a lot of salt in these Cat 5 hurricanes.
Yeah. Lots of salt. It's going to be so much salt.
It's going to be really salty.
Well, shit, I think we've hit. Yeah, you have an appointment. Damn it. Yes. Okay. Maybe we'll just schedule this again for another couple months or something.
Yeah, dude, I would love to. I'd love just chatting with you. It's so much fun. Man.
Always BS good. And I literally had, I like 20 minutes before this, I was like, all right, let me get like some questions, just because I know what I want to talk about. I should come up with stuff. And we still didn't even get through half of those.
Oh, dude, so, I'm sorry. I got really dialed in on the AI and body language. Sorry.
Oh, no, this is great stuff. It's unusual content for my show. That's exactly what I like.
A lot of entropy. It was a lot of entropy.
And so it's always funny, too, like when you're chatting with somebody and like how often there are so many common themes. Like I have literally gone down the body language rabbit hole. Like I said, it's been a long time since I've like kind of been in that circles or stuff, but it is so fascinating. Like, kind of just trying to have some sort of a picture of like underlying things that are present, that are just always present. And I feel like that's what so much of this kind of like, this new discovery layer, I think, or alternative media, whatever the hell you want to call it. Just like this new perspective is trying to find those things. It's like, all right, what's the underlying pieces of the puzzle that we're missing? And all of them fascinate me. Like, they just
so
do.
Much fun.
Like, it's
so much fun.
Crazy.
So many mysteries.
Endless. You know, one thing I always say is, people think we've already discovered everything and like we have all the answers or whatever, like kind of like the normie nihilism or whatever. And I always think like that's always perfectly opposite of the truth, is that every time we have like a new technology or a new communication medium, we actually open up more area that we can now discover than we actually have the potential to achieve, which means that we're actually ever increasing the amount of things that we just discover and understand. Like, quite the opposite of we figured it all out. Like, no, we have more to figure out than we did 30 years ago. Like a lot, like a lot more. So
way more patterns to be sensed.
Yes. Dude, thanks for coming on. How about final thoughts, and where can people find you? I mean, everybody knows where to find you, but do your wrap up.
No, I don't have anything else. Just keep it weird, keep it cosmic, keep learning, and it was an honor to chat with you. I love these chats, guy.
Hell yeah, man. Hell yeah, man. Dude, I'll see you in Nashville.
Yes, looking forward to that.
We'll hang out. All right. Thank you for coming on, dude.
Tell your brother I said hi.
All right. Will do. Will do. Later, man.
See you, bud.
Thank you for listening, guys. I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did. And I really kind of felt like we had to cut it short. And I'm definitely going to have to get Preston Pish back on. Always fun to just kind of like dig with him on all sorts of issues and perspectives on things. And hope to see you guys at the coming conferences. We got BitBlock Boom right around the corner now. It's on April 11th, I believe, is the first day I'm flying out. So I will see you guys in Texas for anybody who is going to be there. And don't forget to check out Preston Pish. We've got links to follow him and see all of his content and stuff right down there in the description, as well as our amazing sponsors, Swan Bitcoin and CoinKite, the makers of the Cold Card hardware wallet. That's how you're going to buy your Bitcoin, and that's how you're going to keep it safe. And it's just that easy. It's just that easy. Check them out. And thank you guys for subscribing. Thank you guys for sharing this out with people. You know, this show moves entirely on word of mouth. So anything that you can do to, you know, present this to other people who are interested, who are at that place where they're trying to dive down the Bitcoin rabbit hole and get their footing and understanding of the space, send them here. Send them to Bitcoin Audible. That's why I do the show. And I think we will save them from a lot of pain and frustration and confusion if they start their journey with Bitcoin Audible. I will catch you on the next one. I'm Guy Swan. Until then, everybody, take it easy, guys.